this is Dr. Jonathan Douglas. I'm a psychologist in Barrie, Ontario, and I am the host of OnPsych, the podcast of the Ontario Psychological Association, which accepts no responsibility, nor should it, for anything I'm going to say today. These are all my own opinions, my own thoughts, my own ramblings, and those poor people have to put up with the fact that they can't control what I say. So, with no further ado, I have with me here a psychologist who is not only so exciting to have on because his area is of tremendous interest to me personally, but also an incredibly patient man, because I'm going to just get this off my chest right now. This is the second time we're doing this podcast because we lost the audio on the last one. It didn't work. And so we're trying to capture lightning in a bottle for a second time today. So thank you so much, Dr. Stephen Taylor, you know, for being back with me 2 weeks later. And I really appreciate you taking the time to do this again.
My pleasure. I'm used to revising and resubmitting, so you know, this is okay. I'll try and not mess up this time like I did last time.
I'm thinking the same thing. This is a chance for me to correct all the horrible errors I made last time. Thank goodness no one will ever hear them. But so allow me to offer the brief introduction as to who you are, and you can perhaps expand on this, but the great and exciting thing about you is that you wrote a book which was released in the fall of 2019 called The Psychology of Pandemics, which is the best timing for publication, as far as I know, in the history of the world. That's just such incredibly, you know, is it good luck? I don't think it's good luck. You know, maybe we should blame you for the whole thing.
Yeah, I think it's dumb luck on my part. I knew a pandemic was coming. We all did. We just didn't know when. Yes. And it was just weird coincidence that it was a few months after the book had been finished.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, obviously sales have been really good.
Yeah.
Much higher than I think you would have anticipated from such a book. It wouldn't have been your book, but George Bush in the White House was reading a book on pandemics during his administration. He already had his eye on the possibility of the next pandemic.
Yeah, yeah, lots of people were. And in fact, in 2018, there were media interviews everywhere, a lot of media interviews talking about the Spanish flu in particular.
Really?
So, yeah, it was a centenary of the Spanish flu. So,
of course.
The zeitgeist was there. People were thinking about pandemics, thinking that the time is ripe for another one for all kinds of reasons. And here we are.
And here we are indeed. Here we are indeed. What is it, do you think, makes us so ripe for a pandemic as we had?
It's a bunch of things. It is growth of the world population, climate change, which is changing habitats, and things like vectors of disease, like mosquitoes, change habitats and they move into temperate climates and people get exposed to diseases they've never been exposed to before. So crowding, travel, and importantly, encroachment on wildlife.
Right.
And of course, wet markets have been implicated as well. So there are a whole bunch of things involved in the emergence of pandemics, mostly to do with what we as humans do.
I imagine, I mean, in terms of the rapid spread, of course, travel was particularly an issue. Obviously, of course, we saw the cruise ships, you know, which are, as far as I can tell, floating Petri dishes.
You know? Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. But we also had air travel, you know, which makes sure that every new variant gets around very rapidly. Every time we hear of a new variant, we can be pretty much certain at this point that it's already in North America.
Yep.
You know, I mean, by the time it gets identified in China, it's here, you know, this kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, so tell me a little bit about yourself, first of all, how you got into this area and, you know, what your practice is like, where you work and all that kind of thing.
Well, I do a mix of things. I do teaching, research, and some clinical practice. I see patients. I do some medical legal expert testimony stuff. But my background for the longest time has been in anxiety disorders and related clinical conditions. So post-traumatic stress disorder, OCD, PTSD, all kinds of things, including health anxiety. I've had a long interest in health anxiety, doing research on it, and written a couple of books on CBT for health anxiety. So with that background, when I started getting exposed to news articles about the Spanish flu in 2018, that piqued my interest, because my interest has been how people respond to health threats and what they do.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Expand on that a little bit for me. How do people respond to health threats?
Well, I think one of the most remarkable things is the heterogeneity of responses, or to put it more simply, but maybe more accurately, the polarization of responses. And it was seen vividly during COVID, polarized attitudes, emotions, and behaviors. So, for example, some people will become highly alarmed and very anxious, whereas other people will dismiss the thing as being either a hoax or an exaggerated threat and so forth. And this is not specific to COVID-19. You can go back to classical Greek times and find the same responses. So all throughout human history, there have been similar responses.
Are there personality variables that are present in that can be identified that sort of separate out who's more likely to go one way versus the other?
Yeah, there are. There are a whole host of personality variables that are relevant. There are the obvious distress proneness personality traits, like negative emotionality. Intolerance of uncertainty is another big one, because pandemics involve so many uncertainties. So people scoring high on those traits would tend to worry, and people who score high on perceived vulnerability to disease, which is linked to health anxiety. So they would be the anxious group. But you also get people who are, say, high on a trait called psychological reactance. And to put it really simply, it's a kind of you're not the boss of me approach, where people value their freedom and they bristle and become resistant and upset and angry when there are threats to their freedom. And so people who score high on that, they don't want to be told what to do by anyone. So there were episodes during COVID-19 where people would sooner die than be told what to do.
Yes, absolutely.
People were getting sick, denying they had COVID, denying that they should do anything, that should have to wear a mask and so forth. So, yes, there are personality traits that lead in both sorts of directions.
It seems to me, too, another one, and this may very well, you know, shade so readily into the political realm, but there's like a dynamic of social responsibility versus I guess individualism, you know, that, you know, I only need to worry about myself.
Yes.
You know, versus I recognize my actions can have an impact on the safety of another. And this is very striking to me, because I feel like this is like a major dynamic as well.
It is. It's a major point of polarity, that conflict between looking after yourself and your family versus care for your community and looking after people there. And oftentimes during COVID and during past pandemics, people were torn. You know, should I bring food to the neighbors who have been shut up for 2 weeks with the Spanish flu? I'd like to do that to help them, but what if I got sick and brought it back to my family? So there have been these conflicts between individual desires and versus that of the community. It's been a feature of just about all the outbreaks I've looked at.
Wow. Yeah, that is really fascinating. I think, you know, after we spoke, you know, I went online and I was looking for some of the COVID anxiety questionnaires. I was curious about how I would score on these. And the answer is not very high. You know, I don't have the emotional anxious component, whereas, you know, what I do have very much to an extraordinary degree is what you call monitoring, right? Mm-hmm. You know, where I'm keeping my eye on things. I'm watching the wastewater data. I'm keeping an eye on the research and, you know, what people are talking about it. I follow epidemiologists on Twitter and all of this kind of a thing. And you know, I'm keeping an eye on it, but without a huge amount of the anxiety. I think I have a sort of a fear for the future, sort of an economic, in a sense, anxiety. What is this thing going to, you know, do to us down the road, right? Much more so than I think I'm worried about my own personal health. It's, I think, yeah, eventually I'm going to get it. You know, I'm probably going to be okay, right? Yeah. I'm not too worried about that. I'm really unwilling to pass it on to somebody else. I think that part bothers me more than my own anxiety.
Yeah.
You know,
I think that's a great example about how many people can monitor threats. You can scan the temporal horizon for threats and not be anxious about it.
Right. Right.
But when a threat arises, when one comes looming in, then people who monitor for threats are more likely to detect the threat and therefore more likely to become worried or concerned.
Sure, sure. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's like, you know, the soldier, right, who's you know, scanning for threats and preparing to respond to them, right? Which, yeah, over the course of time, that can absolutely have an impact on you, for sure.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
The opposite problem is also very prevalent. We talked about monitoring. The converse of monitoring is blunting. People who avoid sorts of threat-related information. And that ties in with denial. And when I talk about denial, I'm not talking about the psychoanalytic concept, although you can. I'm talking more about the cognitive science mechanism of downplaying or dismissing or trivializing threats as a way of feeling safe. And denial at all levels has been a feature of pandemics. At a government level, people would deny that there's a threat in order not to disrupt trade or panic people. And right down to the individual level, people can engage in denial.
Yes. We are so seeing this right now, I believe. Right.
Yes.
You know, based on, well, yeah, climate change, of course, right? You know, that's a great example. But also, you know, with the ongoing pandemic, right? I mean, first of all, you know, we keep hearing about it in the past tense. And you had an interesting take on when a pandemic is over, right? From a psychological perspective, it's over when the anxiety is gone.
Yeah, it's over when people decide it's over, more or less. I mean, that's an oversimplification, but I'm talking about the distinction between a social ending and a physical ending.
Right.
The physical ending is where the disease either fizzles out or becomes benign and endemic. So let's take the Spanish flu again, or the Russian flu. The virus is responsible, seem to have mutated into the ordinary, everyday Russian flu, common cold viruses, and Spanish flu, the seasonal flu. So that's the physical ending. The social ending, which typically occurs before the physical ending, is when, you know, the infection rates are dropping and people say they've had enough and it's time to resume life as it was before.
Right.
And so for COVID-19, the social ending started in 2022. Probably 2022, as people started resuming their lives. They were sick of COVID. They had pandemic fatigue. They wanted it to be over and behaved as if it was over. Many people, not everyone, but
right.
Social ending.
Right, right, exactly, exactly. And, of course, that was aided and abetted by government that wanted to be able to say, hey, we did a great job here. You know, we've got this thing licked. We've got the vaccine now. Everything's fine. You don't need a mask if you've got the vaccine, you know, and all this thing that, of course, turns out to be, from a scientific perspective, just a wee bit over-optimistic.
Exactly, exactly. And just on that, my view is, all of these tools, social distancing, lockdown, masks, vaccines, they all work to some extent, but none
yes.
by itself is a magic bullet.
Oh, absolutely.
And
absolutely.
The next pandemic, we're going to need to pull out all the tools we have to mitigate the spread of infection.
Yes, yes. And yeah, yeah. And honestly, I think, you know, we may need to return to some of them. I think lockdowns will be off the table unless this thing gets really dramatically worse. You know, I don't see lockdowns coming back at all, right? Where a lockdown is defined as, you know, we're not allowing people to go into public settings, right? Because sometimes online I see lockdown being referred to basically as anything, you know, like, you know, the mask mandate was a lockdown in some people's minds. That's not a lockdown. Right.
Yeah, I guess when these terms get released into the wild, People use them in all kinds of different ways. And lockdown's a tricky one. People use it differently. I use lockdown to refer to shelter at home guidelines.
Yes.
Stay in your apartment, stay at home. That's what I consider lockdown. And if you define it that way, lockdown is bad for your mental health.
Oh, yes.
Bad for the economy, bad for mental health. Sometimes it's necessary. The alternatives haven't been as well developed. They might be useful, but so far we've got lockdown. And I hate to say it, if we had COVID-23 tomorrow, governments would put people back in lockdown, but everything that happened during COVID-19 would happen, but a lot faster. There would be an anticipation. You would get the panic buying quicker because people know what to expect. You get the protests quicker, and so forth.
Yes. But
I think we're stuck with some form of lockdown, at least for the time being, as a pandemic mitigation strategy.
If necessary. I don't think – yeah, exactly. But, I mean, you know, I think it probably would be something that the government would be very, very hesitant to move towards. I don't think I'm as optimistic as you are that they would use it, you know, more quickly. I think it would be the last thing they'd want to do.
Then they've got the alternatives. The alternatives haven't been too well developed in Canada. One is a test, trace, isolate approach.
Right.
Where you have everyone with a cell phone, and if I go to a restaurant and someone gets infected, they have a list of all the patrons, I get contacted and told to self-isolate. And you can monitor people's compliance. The problem with that, it involves intensive digital surveillance and all of the problems that come with surveillance, the privacy issues and so forth. But then what happens when infection spreads broadly throughout communities? Test, trace, isolate approaches just aren't feasible, and you have to have a lockdown.
That's right.
The problem is, I think health authorities and governments were just experimenting during COVID-19 because they didn't know the so-called alternatives to the long lockdowns with the so-called circuit breaker things, 2 weeks of lockdown, 2 weeks out. And this just frustrates people. And if you look at the circumstances around the protests and rioting during COVID, and incidentally, despite what people think, there were lots and lots of protests, and some of these turned violent. In fact, some of the protests in the Netherlands around lockdown were the most violent in decades.
Yes.
And these were triggered by either reintroducing lockdown or adding another layer of restrictions. Oh, in addition to closing all the stores early and stuff like that, there's a curfew. You know, you add more and more burdens on people, and people get more and more frustrated and non-compliant. So you can implement lockdown in a way that increases the odds or decreases the odds of rioting. So I think in the future, governments need to be very careful about the way in which they implement lockdowns.
Tell me about that. Like, you know, because I know in your book you had a chapter on, you know, the risk communication, right?
Yeah.
Like, how do we communicate more effectively with the population in order to keep them on board?
It's an enormously challenging enterprise. And I guess during the past 3 years, we've seen vivid examples of how risk communication has failed. Two examples come to mind. The early advice from the WHO that people in the public should not wear masks. Oops.
Yep.
Reversal that confuses people.
Yep.
Another example is our health authorities telling people to stock up on groceries because they're going into lockdown. That precipitated panic buying.
Right.
So we remember the very bad examples, and I guess that's good, remembering what not to do in the future. But the other thing about risk communication, it's tricky. It targets specific groups. Messages grow stale over time, and importantly, messages need to be pilot tested.
Yeah.
And this is why I get many countries have behavioral insight groups that address things like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the mask thing was, you know, that was so difficult because I think the message at first was don't wear a mask, largely because they wanted to keep the masks for healthcare workers.
Yeah.
But they made the mistake of saying don't wear a mask, it won't work anyhow.
Yeah, the WHO offered three reasons and they all turned out to be wrong. They said there wouldn't be enough masks for healthcare workers. Well, that's wrong because you can make your own, or there's N95s everywhere. They said If you wore a mask, you'd touch your eyes and face because you'd be adjusting them. And that didn't happen either. And the third thing they said would happen is there would be what's called risk compensation. And risk compensation is where you adopt one safety behavior and drop others. It was thought, oh, if people wear masks, they'll stop washing their hands. Not true at all. So the WHO were wrong on all three counts and had to reverse their opinions. The problem was a lot of countries, including Canada, were closely following the guidelines of the WHO, and they too had to reverse their stance when it became apparent that the benefits of masks exceeded any disadvantages of them.
Well, and another example of, you know, an error, a clear error, was the failure to acknowledge airborne transmission. You know, the it feels like, I mean, a number of ways, a lot of the communication sort of relied on received truth that, in fact, was no better, you know, had no higher evidence base than any brand new intervention. But so, you know, oh, it's these things are all droplet transmission. Well, it turns out that was never really definitively proven. You know, that goes back to a textbook printed in like 1910 or something like that, that just kept getting quoted again and again and again, right? And it turns out airborne transmission of disease is a lot more common than we ever thought it was.
Exactly, exactly. So the science has had to move along as well. And I suppose that's a confusing thing for the public.
Yes.
Because they're used to getting an answer from scientists, you know, this is what you should do. They're not used to an evolving science where guidelines change over time depending on the accumulation of data. And
I was going to say, I mean, because another piece of that, right? I mean, do you think it's beneficial if a health authority says, we're not sure, but this is what we currently think?
Yeah.
Or does the health authority need to say, this is the way it is? It's a simple message. Here it is. Masks are necessary or masks are not necessary. And we're not going to expand on that, you know, rather than, well, we're not sure. We're going to keep looking into it. But at the moment, it seems that masks might be beneficial and we'll gather the data as we can.
Yeah. There are a couple of things there. One is people want certainty, especially around important issues. Just as an aside, I remember when I was doing first year psychology as an undergrad, I'm sitting through these lectures hoping to get, you know, golden truths and wisdom. And all the prof talked about was things that were theories, things that were probabilistic. This is possibly true. And I sat there thinking, well, this doesn't sound good. Everything's a maybe. Everything's so up in the air. Well, I got used to it. Now I think probabilistically in psychology and so forth.
But
The public are going to say, well, if the government says they don't know, then why should we trust them? So there's that issue of probability.
And that leads to the other problem. If the government speaks with authority and certainty and then has to turn around.
Yeah.
Right. So WHO says, oh, it's droplet transmission. It's clearly not airborne. It's definitively proven this is not airborne. Right. Yeah. Which they did. Right. And now I have to say, yes, it is. And it's like pulling teeth to get it out of them.
Yeah. It's tricky because you don't want to overstate your degree of certainty. But if you understate it, people aren't going to trust you or believe you or follow you. And as you say, if you get it wrong, interesting. I don't want to be seen as bashing the WHO. They have a tough job. But
yes,
they got Ebola wrong twice. In the 1990s, they twice declared an end to the Ebola outbreak in West Africa and turned out to be wrong. Third time, they revised their criteria and got it right.
Revising the criteria is a very helpful strategy.
It's over except for sporadic outbreaks. So it's over but not really over. So it's a really challenging, tricky job where there's so many variables and so much uncertainty.
And this is still an area where, I mean, because another issue, I think, is that of definition, right? You know, where is the line between pandemic and endemic? Nobody knows. Like that's not firmly established in, clear criteria, as far as I understand it.
This is true. And pandemics in general are messy. The ending of pandemics is usually messy. It's not going to outbreaks are unlike the SARS outbreak, which was an epidemic, not a pandemic. SARS just kind of fizzled out and disappeared, SARS-1. More typically, pandemics just kind of have a messy ending. The social ending starts in a physical ending, and then there's a gradual imperceptible change to endemicity. Mm-hmm. You know a disease is endemic after the fact. Mm-hmm. It's hard to sit there and say, oh, this is getting endemic now, because you don't know. It could be just a fluctuation in variants that are circulating. So, yeah, you don't know something's endemic till you're in the middle of it.
Right. Exactly. But as you say, another piece of that can be severity, right? Yes. We're not going to accept something as endemic if it's still, you know, keeping people dying, if it's still filling up hospitals and, you know, and leading to long-term consequences for health. Yeah. Right. And that it does appear to be, you know, where we're at with COVID as of now, right? We're starting to see more and more evidence of the longer term consequences.
Yes, there is that's worrying people. And of course, if you're prone to worry about your health, the whole ending of a pandemic is fueled with uncertainties as well that make people anxious. Should I still be wearing a mask? Should I still be social distancing? Might COVID come back? And compounding this are all these natural processes that occur. For example, the spike in infections after people are released from lockdown. It's happening in China right now, particularly among kids. It's the flu season. People are getting colds and flus. Mm-hmm. There's been a spike in infections because people are out more. But if you're anxious about your health and suddenly there's an increase in infection, people are going to get frightened again and start to worry that the pandemic or a new pandemic might be on the horizon.
Right. Exactly. And we're always in danger of getting out ahead of what the science is saying, right? Yeah, exactly. Certainly a huge part of what we've seen is politicization, right? Yeah. And as you say, this did happen in 1918 as well with the anti-mask league and this kind of a thing. But the polarization politically really had a very surprising impact, in part because, you know, I remember seeing research years and years ago that said, you know, the more politically conservative you were, the more likely you were to be concerned about infection from a stranger. And that this is almost like a genetically driven thing where we would be, you know, sensitive to the possibility that somebody from another tribe, some stranger, might bring a disease into our own group. Right?
Yeah. Well, human beings are tribalistic, and political conservatives, there's a tendency for them to be authoritarian. And if you're authoritarian, you have an acute awareness of the hierarchy structure, who's below you, who's above you, the difference between your tribe or your group and other people. And, you know, when people get threatened with infection, all pandemics come from somewhere else.
Pandemics
are brought in by strangers. That's just the way these things work. And if you're already in a group where you're a cohesive in-group and you're a little nervous about the out-group and there's a pandemic, your xenophobia is going to go right up. So, yes, this has happened before.
I'm aware of this in myself, right? You know, you can tell whether or not I love you by whether or not I'm wearing a mask. Yeah, if I love you, I'm willing to take the risk you might pass the disease to me.
I must share that with my wife and explain why I'm not wearing a mask when I go out with her.
Exactly. But yeah, the confusing thing in that is that it's also part of the political spectrum, you know. You know, the more concerned you are about infection, it seems, the more likely you are to be on the political left. You know, it what strikes me as odd. You know, like not necessarily like there's no inherent link there. You know, it's almost like it sort of switched sides, this anxiety about infection.
Some of it was coming from the leaders, conservative leaders. You know, dismissing it as just being like a little flu or nothing to worry about or a hoax.
Right.
So people follow their leaders. And of course, if you get a political leader who is racist in his pronouncements about the virus, calling it the Wuhan flu and so forth, that's going to serve as a disinhibitory influence that will allow other people with racist attitudes to start voicing and acting on their racism. So political leaders have a powerful impact on how people behave.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I think you're onto something there, because it's also, you know, it ties into essentially, you can't really escape it. It's toxic masculinity, right? The, you know, the fetishization of health and strength, right? And is somehow gets tied into racial purity, you know, and, you know, this whole thing. I mean, there's something strong and as you say, you know, sort of, you know, very, very deeply connected to our sense of identity.
Very much so, yes.
Yeah, yeah, which is a whole fascinating thing in itself.
Hey, OnSeg listeners, Katie here from Jane. I wanted to take a few seconds to say you're doing incredible work. Whether you're a receptionist, office manager, practitioner, or all of the above, we see your commitment to your clients. Jane was built to help you transform that commitment into a thriving business, all while making your day-to-day easier. You can head to jane.app/mental health to read more and see if we can be a good fit for your practice.
I might sort of circle back to something we were talking about earlier, which is sort of like, you know, the role of anxiety versus complacency, right? You know, we very readily, and God knows I see this online because, you know, I get trolls all the time online accusing me of having a mental illness because I'm still concerned about COVID.
Right.
And it's just like, it's just automatic, you know, just, you know, boom, you know, we pathologize that anxiety. And I think perhaps it is a little bit easier to pathologize concern. But there's nothing inherently pathological about, that concern, nor is it automatically the case that complacency isn't pathological.
True.
You know, right? How do we draw that line?
Yeah, I guess it's just like diagnosing mental disorders. There isn't a fine line. There isn't some demarcation point, some border or boundary. It's a gray area, and a realistic concern shades into pathological worry imperceptibly over gradations. So I think in a lot of cases, people need to ask themselves, is my anxiety or my concern a problem in itself?
Yes.
Aside from the concerns about the infection.
Yeah. For me, I think, you know, it's sort of the question of impairment.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, to what degree is there an impairment? And that gets really, I think, challenging in the context of something like the pandemic, because the, you know, if I am so afraid of infection that I'm cutting myself off from others, right, then we might say, okay, that's evidence there of pathology. But then that person might say, oh, yes, but I'm also keeping myself safe from this dangerous, infectious disease that has a 15% rate of causing a long-term problem that can lead to cardiovascular concerns, damage to virtually any organ in the body, you know, shrinks the brain. I mean, you name it, right? And so I'm taking that very seriously. I'm keeping myself away from that, which is the impairment, right? How do we draw that line?
In part, has to do with people's risk tolerance. How much risk are you prepared to accept? And we can't live in a risk-free world. It's impossible. And so for people highly concerned, I think some of them are prepared to accept the degree of impairment in their lives, accept the fact that they're not going to go out as much as they would. And that's an individual choice. But at what point that shades over into a mental disorder? Well, you know, it's a judgment call, isn't it? If the impairment is becoming profound, if the person can't perform social, occupational, or other sorts of roles in their lives, then you might start thinking, well, this is not so much a COVID problem, it's an anxiety problem.
Right. Yeah, I know for myself, going back to that issue of, you know, am I anxious or am I simply rationally concerned, right? You know, what I keep doing is I look for the technological solution, right? So, you know, when the mask mandate was withdrawn, I shaved my beard and upgraded from surgical to N95. Right? Now I've got a better seal, you know, and even though I was a psychologist, I no longer had a beard. It's shocking, I know, you know.
You'll get kicked out of the club if you don't have a beard.
Well, that's right. Exactly. Right. You know, I felt like I'm losing my professional identity. But, I found personally, you know, that, you know, virtually any problem that arises from the pandemic can be solved, you know, with minor adjustment and relying on a technological solution like a mask or something like that, or antiviral sprays, or, you know, all kinds of different things that we can use. And so there are places where I do make that adjustment, mm-hmm. right? This time of year, since we last spoke 2 weeks ago, right? Yes. You know, I think the last time we spoke, I said, oh yeah, as soon as this is over, I'm going to hop online and see what Public Health Ontario has to say about our COVID levels. Well, holy cow, those COVID levels in my local area, you know, last week, right? I guess it was, you know, 1 week ago that this happened, but are now 3.5 times higher than they've been at the highest point in the past year. So we are in an extreme spike right now. So yeah, I'm not eating indoors in restaurants, right? Because that's an environment where my mask I can't rely on my mask, right? You know, there's one restaurant in Ontario that does a fantastic job with HEPA filtration and the whole bit, and they monitor the air and they've got the fresh air coming in and all this kind of a thing. I'd eat there, but they're not in my hometown, right? So, you know, there's very few places that I would trust to be a safe and healthy environment for indoor dining at this time, right? But yeah, it's, you know, other than that, I mean, yeah, I'm going to make that adjustment, but I'm always looking for the way to, you know, fit the thing I want to do, pass it through the filter of my awareness of, you know, the risks, and come out at the other end having fun.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, fair enough too. Fair enough.
Yeah.
And I guess what you're talking about is problem-focused coping. Doing practical things to deal with the situation, which is a good way of dealing with it. Although the interesting thing about pandemics is, of course, you get the emotion-focused coping, focusing on calming your distress. But the really interesting thing, pandemics reveal a side of humanity we rarely see during calmer times.
Yes.
And one of the prominent things during COVID and past pandemics is the rise of superstitious coping and magical thinking.
Yes, let's hear about that.
Well, hygiene theater is probably an example of, you know, an illusion of control, where people thought that scrubbing surfaces, touch screens in stores would keep people safe, and they took it to an extreme. You're placed in an uncontrollable situation, and you think that if you do this one behavior, clean the surfaces, you'll stay safe. So it provides you with an illusion of control. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. If this helps you feel calmer and get out and do the things you need to do, and you don't drop any of your other safety behaviors, you still get vaccinated and so forth, that's fine. But these illusions, and some of them tie in with superstitious rituals and magical thinking, very, very common, particularly when people are faced with unpredictable, uncontrollable stresses. And the other fact is, people know in the back of their minds that the superstitious stuff is something you shouldn't talk about because it seems silly.
Right.
So most people won't talk about the magical rituals, touch wood and Gesundheit and bless you, that sort of thing. Some have. I think I mentioned last time the example of the president of Mexico, who carried these little lucky charms in his wallet, these little lucky cards, and to keep himself safe from COVID. And the only difference between him and everyone else is he told everyone about it. Most people have their own private superstitions they keep to themselves. Anyway, he got up at a news conference and pulled out his wallet and pulled out his little cards and said, "These babies keep me safe." Anyway, shortly thereafter, he came down with COVID. He ditched his lucky cards and went and got proper medical treatment. But
That was good.
Form of Pascal's wager, I guess. But people are highly superstitious, especially when you put them in unpredictable, uncontrollable environments. And we shouldn't be surprised to see a rise of good luck charms, lucky amulets, and other sorts of things.
Or turning towards, you know, the spiritual, right? You know, so long as I have faith, you know, God will protect me or something like that.
Yeah, that's the other polarizing thing. Generally, religiosity increases during pandemics. People become more devotional. They attend church services if available more often. But there's also the among a subgroup of people the opposite, where they throw up their hands and say, well, I might as well party like it's 2019 and not worry about anything. We're all going to die. Let's just have a good time. And we'll see more of that during climate change as that unfolds too. But you do get those extremes.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I mean, there are moments, I have to admit, where I do think to myself, you know, I can see the writing on the wall. I can see where this is going, right?
Yeah.
You know, I'm one of the very few people I see out in the public who are still wearing a mask. Maybe it's gone up a little bit since the recent spike, right? But the vast majority of people are clearly not reading the sources and the science that I'm reading, right? And they're not in the least bit concerned. Our children, of course, are going to school in just a soup of pathogens. Right? They're going to be repeatedly exposed to this disease. And although it's not certain, right, there's the possibility of viral persistence, of immunological damage, right? So, you know, we're not preventing that damage if it's happening.
Yeah.
You know, if that, you know, taking that to the next logical step, right? The future for the economy, for the world, looks pretty dark, right? You know, and so it is tempting at some point to throw up the hands and say, why am I the only one trying to hold the line? You know, what am I holding it for? I mean, you know, do I want to be the one who crawls out of the bomb shelter on the day after the nuclear war?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that gets people frustrated and you get conflicting views and so that can be a tricky, and to some extent, it is a personal decision.
Yes.
Whether you decide I'm going to not wear a mask and build up my immunity versus I'm going to keep myself away because of the potential long-term consequences. I think it's an individual decision.
Well, and that brings us to one of those great pieces of public health messaging, right, that we've been receiving, which is assess your own risk, right? Assess your own risk. And as soon as I heard that, my head exploded, because in my mind, a pandemic demands a pro-social response where I should be assessing the risk of the people around me, not my own risk. My own risk, I'm not worried about. I think I'm going to be okay.
Yeah.
Right. But I don't want to pass it to the person who doesn't even know yet she's pregnant. I don't want to pass it to the person who, you know, isn't vaccinated, the child who, you know, can't wear a mask. Right. I don't want to pass it to the person who's on immunosuppressing drugs that I can't spot. You know, I don't want to cause somebody else's harm. And the message of it's all about your own personal choice, I do find something disturbing in that.
You're right, though. Yes, the message needs to be tweaked, I think. Assess your own risk in relation to others.
Yeah.
Consider other people as well, not just yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Very true. Exactly.
Especially during the active phase of a pandemic where mortality is high. In the endemic phase where viruses mutate and become often less virulent, then I can see how personal decisions would become more important.
Exactly. You know, if it settles down, right?
Yes.
You know, it becomes more optional.
Yeah.
You know, but of course, that's the message that we're getting.
Yeah.
You know, that you know. And it's true. It's true. I want to acknowledge that, right? You know, I mean, on an individual case-by-case basis, right, you know, the risk of hospitalization is down. The risk of death is considerably down.
Yeah.
Right. From an acute infection.
Yes.
Right. What we're not seeing is the elimination of the risk of death on average in the excess death. Right. Because we're seeing people who, you know, survive the infection and then subsequently have a heart attack, have a stroke, have suffer some organ failure of some kind that we can't necessarily definitively prove is linked to the pandemic. And of course, we no longer have a control group, right?
True.
Well, we do, but it's just me and my wife, you know. You know, so the risk of caused by an individual infection is down, but the risk to society remains. And the risk of overwhelming healthcare and this kind of a thing continues to persist as well.
Mm-hmm. Not just for COVID, but for other diseases that will be coming down the track with changes in climate and so forth. This sounds really gloomy, but it sounds like our future will be hotter, more crowded, older, and sicker.
Well, if the pandemic has its way, the crowd will take care of itself. Few good disasters, you know, another pandemic or two. Oh my gosh, real estate prices will come way down, Stephen.
You know, it sounds macabre or bleak, but people will survive. I'm reminded
the human race is going to survive.
AD 536 was considered by some historians the worst year ever to be alive. There were three volcanic eruptions which clouded the world or Western Hemisphere in perpetual gloom for 2 years. So it was dark and gloomy. Crops failed. There were plagues and wars and all that stuff was happening. So yeah, plagues, wars, and pandemics typically go together for a variety of reasons. So when I'm having a bad day, I think about AD 536 and remind myself I'm not alive then. But more to the point, people survived.
Yes.
Humans as a species got through that and survived. So I think we need to remind ourselves about our remarkable capacity for surviving infectious ordeals.
I hold on to the concept of zooming out.
Yep.
You know, if you zoom out far enough, right? First of all, I mean, consider this. I mean, how far back can you trace your ancestors and know anything about them beyond their name and where they got married and when they died?
Well, right? I've got a bit. I've gone back about 7 generations.
You're a bad example.
There are huge databases out there, birth, deaths, and marriages, and census records. They'll tell you all kinds of stuff. Or if you're like me, if you're born in Australia, chances are you had ancestors who were convicts.
That's right.
Three of them. And they are documented in exquisite detail, including anthropomorphic descriptions.
Of course. I believe my genealogy dates back about 300 years, into Ireland and County Cork.
Oh, same.
We're
related, you know.
That's right. Exactly. But, what do you actually know about these people, right?
That's the thing.
Of course, our children will have exactly the opposite problem. We will know so much about them, because of social media and because of landfills and all the rest of it, that we'll just be overwhelmed with information, which is almost the same problem in, exactly the opposite way.
But that raises a challenge that I've been grappling with in the psychology of pandemics is the historical record.
Yes.
When I started working on my pandemic book, unknown to me, a colleague in Melbourne, he got a team together and they were looking at the psychology of pandemics as well in 2008. They gave up. They couldn't find enough material. I found material, but it took a lot of work. You go into the historical records and look for memoirs. Newspaper reports are okay, but you're looking for memoirs and historical documents. So, you can find them. You can find descriptions of the plague written in the 1600s that will describe the psychological phenomenon. But you really have to dig and search to find these things, but they're
and out. Then they're like gold when you find it.
Oh yeah, it's treasure.
Oh, this is fantastic! Look what I found. This monk wrote down what was going on. Right? Yeah, yeah. You know, it's this wonderful. Today, you're going to have 8,000 Twitter accounts that won't even scratch the surface of what's out there. Yeah. And it, you know, filtering that is just going to be just as hard.
Yeah, it's another form of the infodemic.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You have, because we talked about this, edition two of your book coming out, or a brand new book. Which is it?
It's a brand new book. It's called, well, The New Psychology of Pandemics. And it emphasizes fear, resilience, and polarization. So it builds on the first book, but it goes off in a number of new directions or explores things that weren't explored in that much detail in the new book. It is three times bigger than the old one. And it's not just COVID. Interestingly, more research has been done on COVID than there's been ever any research on the psychology of pandemics.
Yes.
And a lot of the there was some good COVID research, but we're in the infodemic. A lot of the COVID research was junk. Take the PTSD research. There's a recent study found that 70% of PTSD studies during COVID didn't assess PTSD properly. They didn't assess a traumatic stressor.
Right.
Didn't assess it properly. So there's a lot of junk science out there too.
Yes.
So that makes my task reviewing the literature a little challenging. So you're right.
Yes.
But fortunately, just about everything that happened in COVID has happened in past pandemics, which makes the job a little easier in terms of what you're looking for.
But yes,
the new book takes off in some – it's consistent with the old one. And it elaborates on, I mean, what I was able to do in the past 3 years is dig deeper into the historical archives and find some more material. And, of course, the COVID research. And my research group and I were active in doing research all through COVID-19 on the psychology of COVID. So I have a first draft of the new book, but it should be ready, I hope, in about 3 months.
Okay, very good. So publication date probably late 2024?
I'm hoping, if all goes well, yeah. And I'm still
excellent.
I'm still polishing it.
Excellent, excellent. Christmas 2024. I'll be sure to put it
Every
on my list.
Should have on the ideal Christmas present, all that sort of thing.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So what do you think is the most important thing that you've learned since 2019?
Oh, that's a goodie. I think there's a host of them. One is the polarization processes that go on, that people talk themselves into extreme views, and it's a social psychological phenomenon. So that struck me as being important, that wasn't given sufficient emphasis in the book. The other thing was how superstitious people are, how prevalent magical thinking is, especially when people are under stress. And I guess the third thing that really struck home is pandemics, as I mentioned before, they reveal a side of humanity we don't see during calmer times. During COVID, for example, there was a rise in non-delusional paranoia and people becoming more mistrustful and more suspicious of others. It was quite likely a situational thing, the pandemic with the threats and the lockdowns and the panic buying and so forth.
And the conspiracy theories.
Yes, and conspiracy theories, increased interpersonal mistrust. And once the threat abates, that should abate too with most people.
Yeah.
I guess they were the some of the main things that struck me in the past 3 years.
I remember in your book, there was a section about rumors and conspiracy theories. And, conspiracy theory is basically a special form of rumor.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, just a sort of a more technologically based one.
Yes.
And this is something we talked about last time a little bit as well. I mean, and maybe this is my conspiracy theory. But it seems to me that there's been a lot of manipulation of social media. You know, there was a study done that, you know, something like 10 Twitter accounts were responsible for, you know, the vast majority of misinformation being spread you know?
12. They're 12? They're called the Disinformation Dozen.
That's their right. Name.
One of the Kennedys is prominent in that. Robert Kennedy yes. Jr., I think.
Robert F. Kennedy Jr., yes.
Prominent anti-vaxxer. But the research I've read is you can track that the core of the misinformation comes from about a dozen people. Yeah. Social media influencers or Twitter influencers.
Right, right. But there's also, of course, the army of bots, right? The trolls, the people with, you know, first name numbers as their account,
yeah.
Their account's been in existence since September and they've got 4 followers, but they're spreading all this stuff as much as they can. They're, you know, and I get these responses all the time with, you know, cry, laugh, clown. Well, thanks for the meaningful engagement. But there's been a lot of, elevation of misinformation, malinformation, you might say, because I think it's truly, you know, misinformation. I can be mistaken and believe something and elevate it, right, if I truly believe it. But malinformation is I'm going to invent this. I'm going to spread it even though I don't believe it. I know it's not factual, but it's pushing my agenda, whatever my agenda happens to be, right? And it seems like there's a lot of that going on social media.
Yeah, there is a lot. And some of this is spread for trollery, which are kind of sadistic, psychopathic gains where your cry, laugh, clown emoji summarize it all. Trolls take delight about winding people up, about eliciting yes. Anger or indignation or upset, and they find that entertaining. So it's a personality trait called negative social potency. So these people get a kick out of watching the world burn.
Yes.
And the internet, particularly if you're in lockdown with nothing better to do, provides a venue for doing that. So those people spread misinformation, but they're not the only ones. There's also the conspiracy theory entrepreneurs, the people who make a buck out of promoting the these theories and tying them into their products, whether they're immune-boosting products or other things like that. There are plenty of conspiracy entrepreneurs.
Colloidal silver?
Colloidal silver is one of them, yes.
Yes. Yep. Yeah, ivermectin, you know, all of these things. Which raises another fascinating thing to me. Why is it more politically conservative? Why is it more consistent with conservative ideology to treat a disease rather than engage in prevention? Because it seems like, you know, this drive towards, you don't need to prevent, you just need to, you know, catch it early and treat it with ivermectin, you know, get that Paxlovid in there or whatever it is, right? And that's, you know, valuable, but the vaccine, no, you don't want that. The masks, you don't want that, because it's all about treating the disease instead of preventing it. And again, logically, I look at this and I don't see any logical link there. I would think, you know, if you are economically conservative, you surely would want to prevent the disease, because that's going to cost so much less to prevent than it is to treat.
Yeah.
And the economic costs of, you know, people being off work and, you know, disruption in the supply chain or whatever. Why would we not want to prevent the disease if our goal is to support the economy?
Exactly. I think it highlights the fact that human beings are not very rational in their decision making.
Really?
Yeah. I've read books on pandemic management written by disease expert epidemiologists. And they all trot out more or less the same thing that you should do. We should give people more information. We should do more lockdowns, more vaccines. And they dismiss with bewilderment the irrationality of people. They treat it as some kind of weird fluff that we don't need to worry about, you know, like the panic buying. Well, the irrationality is precisely the stuff they need to focus on, because that is what makes pandemics difficult to manage.
Right.
The political polarization, the reliance on magical thinking, the illusions of control, all of those things.
We need to speak to emotion.
Yes.
In other words,
yes.
Right? We need to speak to emotion. And so one of the things I think, you know, that prevention speaks to is anxiety.
Yes.
But what treatment speaks to is hope.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, so that's a fascinating thing right there. And of course, a major failure in a lot of communication.
Yeah.
Right?
Based on the assumption of we just dump more information on people, they'll get better and realize what they should be doing. But as you say, the messages weren't getting to the people's emotions and their motivations and their values and their fears.
It'll work great for us monitors, but it'll be lousy for the blunters. Right. Yeah, how true. So how do we effectively communicate to the blunters?
Well, this is tricky because those people are the people who tend to avoid threats. And, you know, they're the ones who go into the doctor's office and say, just tell me what I need to know. I don't
yes.
need a whole lot of detail. But the challenge for blunters during a pandemic, particularly in an era of 24/7 news cycle and social media, is it's very hard to be a blunter these days. Unless you live in a cave in the Andes, you're going to be bombarded with disease-related information if there's a pandemic on. So how do we deal with the blunters? Well, I think blunters find that it's very difficult to be a blunter in these circumstances.
Oh, I wish that were true. But I think what happens is the blunters get angry and they start lashing out. You know, they start attacking the sources. And they start questioning the validity of the sources. You know, oh, you're a pharmaceutical shill. You know, you're scared. You know, they look for ways to undermine the source.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, and start to, you know, question its legitimacy.
Yeah.
That
gets at another facet that I think epidemiologists and people involved in disease modeling and constructing pandemic mitigation strategies underestimate the irrationality and emotion and things like that. And that you will get people who engage in motivated reasoning, like the blunters yeah. lashing out that you mentioned.
Right.
A wish fulfilling thinking is one version, but people are motivated to find ways of keeping their worldviews stable and constant and of defending their beliefs. And again, people who are blunters might engage in that kind of reasoning to downplay the significance of a threat they don't want to acknowledge.
If we can identify somebody's values, then we can identify what they're most concerned about, and we can speak to that. Does that make sense?
I think that's an important part, but you need to consider the people in the person's social network, mm-hmm. their close friends and what their friends and colleagues and so forth, the information they're inputting to them as well. Because human beings by nature are conformist and imitative. Most of it, this is what makes society work. The other day, my wife was complaining about sheeple. And I said, hey, you're giving sheeple a bad rap. Everyone has a bit of sheeple in them, and we need sheeple to make the society work. If you're 100% sheeple, that might be a problem, but we need a little bit of sheepleness in all of us.
Yes, yes. You're reminding me of a cartoon I saw recently of, a couple of sheep, you know, wearing masks, you know, and a group of lemmings plunging off of the cliff beside them, you know, and a couple of lemmings turning to each other and saying, ha, look at the sheep.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah. 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 But yeah, we're all members of society. We're all influenced, right? You know, and I think one of the more remarkable pieces of data I've seen is the number of people that would very happily put on masks right now, if only they were mandated, right? They're not making that choice for themselves because they don't want to be the ones to stand out. You know, Ash's classic experiment, right? Yeah. Of, you know, yeah. You've got somebody's being brought in to say, very simple task, which of these two lines is longer, right? And they don't know that the other people in the group are confederates of the experimenter. So, you know, that person, oh yes, you know, line A is longer, everyone agrees, line B is longer, everyone agrees. And then, oh, wait a second, everyone else is saying line A is longer, but it's clearly line B. What do you do? And an awful lot of people agree with the group over their own perceptions. And of course, this is exactly a huge part of the problem right now, because if you look, the evidence of our eyes right now is that nobody's worried about the pandemic. How do we know? Nobody's wearing a mask. It's very visual, right?
The other thing is pandemics end when people shift their preoccupation to other things. And the social ending of COVID is definitely here because most people, the media, are concerned with climate change. It's been a return to climate change. Everyone's talking about climate change. COVID has taken a back seat. People's concerns have shifted. So that's happened time and again during pandemics.
Absolutely. It absolutely has. And it's an absolutely natural process. But going back to that concern that I've got with, I would say, based on what I know about it, as a psychologist, big asterisk here, I'm not an infectious disease specialist. I'm not an epidemiologist. I'm talking here about as someone who spends too much time on social media. But if COVID proves to be persistent in the body and activates the immune system, overactivates it, and then ultimately exhausts it, right? And if that's a process that happens after X number of exposures, you know, to COVID, then we're in big trouble. And so we need people to reactivate their concern out of the precautionary principle. This could happen. We have a chance to stop it from happening. We need to get people back on board with making sure it doesn't happen. And yet nobody wants to hear it. Mm. And maybe I'm wrong.
At least getting more research to find out who is especially vulnerable. Because long COVID develops only in a fraction of people. And most people who get long COVID recover within months. Some people, as you say, I know several people who've developed permanent or residual impairments as a result of COVID, hearing deficits, for example. So those things happen. That's a fraction of individuals. I guess in a lot of cases, it's a judgment call, figuring out, well, the most dangerous thing I do in my life is crossing the street. Am I going to stop doing that because there's a high odds that I'll be, an odd chance I'll be run over by a bus? So it's people accepting or trying to decide what's an acceptable risk in their lives, and of course balancing the other considerations, the other people in their lives as well.
Exactly. And you know, the very extraordinarily difficult position I think that parents are put into, you know, I mean, what are your choices, right? You know, if you try to protect your children from this, you know, still potentially dangerous disease with uncertain long-term implications, then we do certain damage to their psychological, social development, right?
And their immunity debt too. If they're not exposed to common everyday pathogens because they're in lockdown, they're going to build up a kind of an immunity debt, and you're going to see that post-lockdown spike of infections too. So there are a lot of considerations for parents.
Yeah. Now, I've heard it said, though, in terms of immunity debt, that immunity debt does have a realistic basis on a population level, but it's not really a thing on an individual level, right? You're getting a certain amount of benefit from bacterial exposure, you know, from dirt and this kind of a thing, but there's no real benefit to a child from having a virus, right? You know, so that's a controversial concept, the immunity debt.
It is, but nonetheless, we're seeing a spike of infections now post-lockdown from kids who have not been exposed to the various bugs that they would usually get exposed to.
Right. But most kids right now are exposed to COVID, right? So another alternative hypothesis is that immunological damage. Right. And these are questions that, you know, are very valid questions that we still have to get the answers for. Right. That's, you know, what this is about. Right. We're not certain yet. But that, again, speaks to that precautionary principle, the what if. Right.
And it also speaks to one's tolerance for uncertainty. This is another example of, about the massive uncertainties associated with pandemics. And in order to emotionally survive pandemics or other global calamities, people need to be able to tolerate some degree of uncertainty in their lives.
Exactly. Exactly. You know, and I think that, you know, all of us have that tendency to, you know, deal with uncertainty by leaping to a conclusion, right? Either that it is obviously dangerous or it is obviously not dangerous. And it's very hard to sit with, we don't know yet, right? We don't know yet.
And I think that's called need for cognitive closure.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
People who score high on that need an answer, they latch onto it and don't move from that answer.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Well, another thing that we need is, what was that phrase you had the about the trolls? The antisocial, something about their social power.
Negative social potency.
Negative social potency. Yes.
Yeah, it's not my idea. It's a trait from people who've studied trolls and trollery.
Absolutely. But we need more positive, you know, social, I lost the word again.
If people want a sense of agency, for trolls, it's creating mischief or watching the world burn. For other people, it's out doing pro-social things. But even that comes with a price. If I could just turn to climate change for a second, one of the problems we're seeing is burnout among climate activists. People who are struggling to do the right thing about climate change. They're doing it personally and in the broader community. They're frustrated about all the obstacles or the people not taking seriously. And they experience something similar to job burnout, emotional burnout. And there have been some suicides around this too.
Oh, yeah. Because they're losing hope, right? You know, they've devoted their lives to trying to stop this thing, and it's not stopping, and very few other people are on board, right? And
there's a downside to pro-social engagement too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because you can. Yeah, it's a lonely thing, right? It becomes a lonely thing. You know, it really does.
That's where social support and getting in with a group with a common goal can help motivate people through these things.
Yes, yes, absolutely, absolutely. Well, I really want to thank you so much for taking this time with me times two. It's been a great pleasure speaking to you. A lot of fun, and I really appreciate it. So the book is going to be The New Psychology of Pandemics, coming to bookstores imminently in a year.
Well, I hope so. We'll see, but it's getting there. I got a first draft.
It's getting there.
Just got to clean it up a bit.
Excellent. Excellent. When we meet face to face, I will have you sign my iPad because I have the Kindle edition of your current book.
Sounds good.
All right. Thank you so much, Stephen. Do appreciate
thank you very much for inviting me on your program. I really appreciate it.
It's my very great pleasure. Take care.
Yeah. Thanks very much. Cheers.
Hey there. This is Katie from Jane. Thanks for letting our team be a part of your listening experience over these past few months. We're proud to be sponsors of the Ontario Psychological Association and the OnPsych podcast. If you're new to Jane, let me tell you a bit about us. Jane is complete practice management software that can help you navigate your day-to-day with ease and flexibility. This means simple scheduling, streamlined billing, intuitive charting, and so much more. We'd love to meet you and hear your story. Our team is only a phone call or email away, and you can find us over at jane.app/mental health. We look forward to hearing from you.
You have been listening to On Psych, presented by the Ontario Psychological Association. Be sure to subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.